Father God, thank you so much for Mount Hermon and the sacred place that it is, a place to retreat, a place to join you, a place to slow down. And Lord, I pray for the people here who have their own story that you're in, and we're going to discuss some hard things, Lord, and I pray, Father, that you use me and my experience and the words I'm going to say to help guide them, encourage them, and help them to know what to do in these difficult situations. And it's in your name, amen. Okay. So we got a fire hose of information coming. So I apologize. Because just one of these subjects we could spend days on. And my goal, as best as possible, is to educate you a little bit about them and help you to understand what potentially you can do if you have people in your life who have struggled with these issues. And I'm specifically going to do it through the lens of a teenager. My experience in my private practice is with teenagers and young adults. And before we really dive into the issues, I want to help you understand a little bit about what's going on in the teenage world. And I specifically want to talk about their developmental stage that they're in, the things. So, you know, for us to be able to learn through reading, we need to learn how to read first, right? So there are these developmental tasks that at each age we have to accomplish in order to be prepared for the next one. And so adolescence is really important because it's right before adulthood. So the stage of adolescence is really important to be able to get through these tasks so that they're prepared to be independent adults. So we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about what's going on in their brain because it's kind of nuts. So some developmental tasks that go on for the adolescent is the identity issue. It's the who am I? What makes up me? And the difficult thing about the adolescent is that the way they figure this out is through opposition and risk-taking. And they are needing to be different in order to figure out who they are. If you think about adolescence, they're, okay, so if you can picture a daisy, right, and you're looking down at a daisy, that what happens is home is the little yellow part in the middle, and what they're doing is they're tracing that petal. They're going out into the world, whether it's their phone, whether it's with friends, and they are collecting information, trying things, and they're saying, and then they're bringing it back home, and they're going, is this me? Is this not me? Right? It's that identity piece. They might listen to a certain kind of music for a while and go, is this a fit? Dress like this? Hang out with these people? They're trying to collect information to figure out who they are. Now, if home, the center, is chaotic and not safe, then what happens is teens just spin. There's no rest. So home, for adolescents, for teens, it's really important. They need a safe place to just process what they've learned in class at school. And parents are the best place, I think, for that, to kind of give them some roots in this developmental phase. The second thing that's really important for the teen is to figure out how are they different from you as parents. Autonomy. So identity and autonomy are really important developmental tasks for the teen to figure out. And in autonomy, what kids are trying to do, almost all kids, even the ones that are really rebellious, they want to have positive connections to their parents. And at the same time, by opposition and risk-taking, figure out who they are. And so what happens when the kid is two parts, they tend to minimize what they're actually doing, straight out lie, or they secret keep in order to kind of still be close to mom and dad or primary caretaker, and then also experience life. The other two things that are really important for adolescents are peer relationships, they need to figure out relational skills. Now, as adults, we have jobs. We need to be able to conflict resolute with our team. We need to be able to advocate. We need to be able to communicate well. And they learn this in their peer development. How do I relate to the opposite sex? This is really important part of being a teenager. And then the last developmental task is really formal operation skills. What's happening in the world? What's my part in this? How am I to help? They start to think abstractly, and they start to wonder their place and what's going on around them. And so those are really important pieces of an adolescent. And what I love about working with kids in my office is I think that the most important questions we ask ourselves is about who I am and who God is. And so they're wrestling with these things in relation to their peers, in relation to something they saw on YouTube, something they learned in biology. They're trying to figure out who they are, how they're different from their parents, and what that means for their life. And so as a clinician, I get this really neat opportunity to go deep with them. And I think as parents, you too have opportunity to be a part of that discussion. But what's happening in the brain? So this is when you're little, when you're 2, 3, just born, your brain is growing lots of dendrites, it's almost like, it's like a bush. So there's all these pathways that are all over the place, right? But your brain isn't very fast when you have multiple ways. So if you have a signal in the brain that wants to go from one end to the other, when there's so many ways, it kind of is slow, right? So what's happening in adolescence is pruning is going on. So the areas that are being used or influenced are the areas that are staying, and then the areas that are not being used, they get pruned. So now the pathway is much faster. So use it, keep it. Don't use it, it gets pruned. And that's why the teenage brain is so important to protect from negative influences, because it's much more difficult to recover because it's so influential. Dopamine, which is something that is a part of, very important part of learning. It's really important part of the training that goes on in the brain. And because it's susceptible, it can grow and learn and do great things. And at the same time, if there's substances being used, if they're depressed, if they're not sleeping well, then that also creates these pathways in the brain. Does that make sense? No, it
will.
It's almost like you think of the brain as this like meadow of long grass. And once you're used to doing something a certain way, you go that same pathway. It gets kind of pushed down, right? So now that's the way to go from one side of the field to the other. Does that make sense? So the areas that are not being used get pruned. So there's just one. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, so that was a great question about video games and its effect on the brain. So what we do know, and this is where I wish I had my outlines because there's a lot of resources on there, but what we do know is if dopamine is affected by anything, it can be habit forming because it's an endorphin. It's something that is enjoyable. So there's things that are substances that affect the dopamine level of the brain, but also processes, right? So, and we're going to talk about some of them. Gambling, sadly, statistically, some current research is out there that any screen time tends to, and specifically social media, increases depression and anxiety, which affects those very things that you're talking about. And gaming is a part of that. It is not as bad as social media. I would even probably put YouTube a little bit farther than video gaming, but it still has a negative effect. And we're going to talk about the difference between sometimes playing video games, sometimes doing certain things, and addiction. Because I want you guys to understand there's a continuum there. So just because if something is going on in your kid's life or someone you care about doesn't mean that they're an addict. Does that make sense? Yeah. Crazy, yeah.
And I know that, like, you're talking about, like, psychology stuff. But, so I know that, it, the pruning happens. Is it, like, a slow process from, like, two on, or is it, like, it gets pruned, and then adolescence just gets really pruned? Is it, like, a hyper-sensitive, time period, or?
So here's an interesting thing about the brain. It's not done growing until your late 20s, early 30s. And then after that, it's like this. So me turning 50 this year, I'm all, great, that's why I can't remember what I was supposed to buy at Target. In fact, one time I went to Target, literally, I knew it was upstairs, and I'm just walking around desperate trying to find whatever it was, and I figured it out. But anyway, so that's why the brain is so important to be protected. I mean, if you're going to use a substance, wait till after, you know, because then it's kind of you're kind of hardwired already. But I would say that pruning kind of really starts to begin eighth grade, 13, 14 is when that pruning process starts. And so that's why that influence on the brain is so important. So a lot of gaming is going to have an impact on the brain. Not enough sleep is going to have an impact on the brain. Does that make sense? Substances affect on the brain. Okay, so let's move to some of these issues more specifically. And then at the very end, I'm going to kind of talk about what do we do about them. Yay! Outline. Okay, here we go. I'm only going to talk a little bit about each subject and then talk about what to do at the end. And okay, so the first part about substances I want to only talk about are really alcohol and marijuana, because those are the two that are most prevalent with teenagers these days. Teens, specifically for alcohol, they drink more dangerously. So they drink less often, but they drink almost twice as much. So they binge drink. And what is a binge? Surprisingly, a binge is 4 to 5 drinks with a 2-hour period. 4 for women, 2 for men, or 5 for men. So you may think, wow, 4 drinks within a 2-hour period, maybe I'm close to that. You need to think about that. That has an effect on your brain. For an adolescent, what seems typical in my experience is they'll do 4 to 5 shots within a minute or two and then start to drink. That just starts their night. And so when I try to educate kids, I just go, let me help you understand what that is and how that's affecting your brain. The other little piece of alcohol I want to help you guys understand too is that if you have alcoholism, substance use in your family tree, research has shown that if you're a child of an alcoholic or a substance user, you're 4 times as likely to develop alcoholism yourself. So they definitely are realizing that there is a genetic brain link. And so that puts your kid potentially in more of a risk to develop struggles later in life. In fact, this is true for even kids who have been adopted out and are, you know, in a home that deals with these things very well, they still tend to struggle. What they found was that they are alcohol naive. So they did a study and they self-reported that they were actually really fine, but they weren't. When you looked at their blood alcohol level, it was very high, but they said, they're fine, I can. They reported less intoxication, less impairment in their ability to do things and to understand things. Whereas people who don't have that in their family tree, they're able to go, whoa, nope, this is too much. I don't want to do this. I need to stop. And so if you lack that self-awareness, then you're going to make choices like to continue to drink or to take risks like driving. And so that's all I really want to say about alcohol. We're going to talk a little bit about marijuana and intoxication symptoms and that sort of thing so that you can kind of understand what to expect with that. Because with marijuana, especially because of the passing of recent laws, It's the most used substance for teens. It's the most common drug. And I would say it's probably more preferred even than alcohol in some circles. And with, again, the teenage brain being affected by marijuana, a lot of times kids will say, oh, it's not a big deal. It's just an herb. I'm like, well, it still affects dopamine level. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yes. Yes. And with the form, so it's, so he made, just for the audio, someone had brought up that marijuana today is much stronger than marijuana of yesterday. And that's absolutely true. So it's not just the strength is more highly concentrated. The forms in which you can get THC is crazy. It's not just coming in bud form. Now it comes in dabs, it comes in an oil, it comes, and it's so much more easily accessible. So we got to be really careful about that. Okay, so what are the symptoms of intoxication? I'm going to try to push us through a little bit so we can get to some of this information. Well, something to know too, if you have a child who really deals with this issue and you're trying to hold them accountable to making better decisions and you're deciding to test them to see what's going on, marijuana will stay in your system a month after use, which makes it really difficult as parents to try to figure out what to do because it sticks around for so long. So even though the immediate effect is worn off after a couple of hours, it can stay in your system for quite a long time. So what are some immediate intoxication symptoms? There's impaired motion. They're slower. They feel euphoric. Impaired judgment, social withdrawal, increased appetite, we kind of know that one, and a rapid heart rate. And withdrawal symptoms are important to know too. And what withdrawal symptoms come from more habitual use, that these things will be seen maybe in the kids that you're around, is that they tend to crave. Again, marijuana affects dopamine level in the brain, so it's habit forming, it's addictive. Coming off of that high, aggression can increase. Irritability can increase, sleep will be off. Even nervousness and anxiety can be, because it's considered a hallucinogenic, actually not a depressant like alcohol, but it kind of smushes, it slows everything down. So once that comes out, then now you're trying to cope with normal emotion and it feels crazy because you're not used to it, depending upon how much you use. Concentration problems are an issue. And I can go into more stats about how much it affects a kid's ability to do well in school, depending upon if it's habit forming, it's something they use often. It absolutely will affect IQ and ability to perform well. We know that these two things aren't good for the kids. But I think what I want you to know about specifically about substances is, how do you know, let's say you discover something, and this is usually how you find out as a parent, is they usually don't tell you. You usually discover something or someone tells you something. What is the difference between use and addiction? So there's a continuum here I want you to kind of keep in mind as we talk about these things. So the first is just experimental. You try it once. What's it like? A little bit more than that is going to be social recreational use. It will be something that they do with friends. If you just think about any sort of substance use, maybe people will have a glass of wine because it's a holiday, but they normally don't. So with teens, it's experimentation, recreation, social. That's usually done with people. And then a little bit more use is habitual. It's a habit. It's something that happens. There's a pattern of use. Does that make sense? It's pretty often. And then abuse is not just habitual, but amounts. You're using a lot. You're drinking a lot. You're smoking a lot. And then addiction has multiple symptoms. So you go from experimenting, trying something one time, all the way to addiction. And so when you work with kids, part of it is to try to figure out what's going on in their use. Okay, so addiction symptoms are important to understand. And these addiction symptoms are also applicable to process addiction, which we kind of talked about with video gaming. These sort of things still will happen. They'll just not crave the substance. They will crave whatever it is that they're doing to cope. So craving, that's one of them. Your life becomes unmanageable. Things start to unravel. You're not able to do well in school. You're showing up to work late. Your relationships are chaotic. So life becomes unmanageable. And the other part about addiction is that you continue to do this even though it's unmanageable, even though you have great consequence, right? So even though you got a DUI, you still drink. You still use a substance. For most people, if they've done something and there's a negative consequence, that wakes you up. But someone who's addicted, it doesn't make a difference, okay? Loss of control over use, they can't say no. There's preoccupation with the drug or process addiction. They're thinking about it. They're at work and they're thinking, I'm gonna go to this liquor store because I only go there once a week and then I go to this one. There's thought about how to get to this thing that's going to take care of how they feel. There's physical dependency, there's and also tolerance, which is maybe one beer would give them a certain effect. Now they need a lot more. So it loses its potency, if that makes sense. So a kid smoking pot, they're going to have to do a lot more in order for it to have the same effect. Okay, so now we're going to go on to self-injury and then to suicide. And then at the end, we'll talk about a little bit about what to do. So self-injury, and this is a really clinical definition, but I heard it in a class at Cal. It's really good. It's a behavior involving deliberate, self-inflicted, non-lethal bodily harm. And it's not socially acceptable. And it's performed to reduce stress without intent to take their life. Let me say it again. A behavior involving deliberate, self-inflicted, low-lethal bodily harm of a socially unacceptable nature performed to reduce stress.
One question. Might it be socially acceptable?
There's different types of self-harm, and we're going to talk about that one. So this is what we've kind of already talked about, is a process addiction. The brain, after a self-injury, responds just like they just smoked pot. There is relief. There is a dopamine surge. Those endorphins do affect and is pleasurable. And that's why it's habit-forming. Let's see. So the most common methods are cutting and burning. Sometimes risky, high-risk behavior can be, there's an intent to deal with emotion, potentially. And eating disorders also sits in this category. It is habit-forming, it can become addiction, and it does affect the dopamine levels, like the binge-purge cycle, specifically. Okay, so you brought up, can it be a socially acceptable thing? There's a non-dissociative type. And dissociation is where you're not fully present when you self-harm. You're almost checked out. Like, you know, an example of disassociation that we probably experience is that you're driving in your car after a long day at work, and you get home, and you're like, I don't remember driving at all. That's a form of disassociation. Your body's working, but you're not fully there, okay? So the non-dissociative type tends to be public, it tends to not be a secret, and it can be something that a social circle kind of talks about. If there's that positive reinforcement in a group for kids, it can be valued and then encouraged and supported from each other. And then sometimes they share tips, unfortunately. Yeah. Okay, so there's a group of junior high girls who are friends, and they unfortunately watched the show 13 Reasons Why, which as a clinician, I can't tell you how angry with the entertainment industry I am about that. And they are talking about it and someone shares, oh, last night, look at the scar I got. You know, my mom didn't catch me. I just used the razor from the, you know, it's almost like attention seeking sometimes. But again, if the social situation affirms that and says, ooh, that's, how did that feel? That was kind of cool. Then that's how it's kind of supported. Does that make sense? But I would say the non-dissociative type is a cry for help. It is like sometimes I'm not okay. And those kids are a little bit more willing to tell parents about that. And they usually don't do it very often. It doesn't continue as long. But it's the non-dissociative, or it's the dissociative type that I most get nervous about, in that it's secretive. And the physical pain becomes this cure for their emotional pain. And it usually starts with really highly intense feelings of distress. And again, it is habit forming. So risk factors to this sort of behavior is feeling powerless and hopeless, emotionally isolated. I can tell from my clients that they lack peer validation. They don't have good relationships. They come from a family environment that is emotionally invalidating. And what that means is if the kid is having struggles, the family tells them to suck it up. There's not a lot of empathy. There's not a lot of help to deal with that emotion. Families that are invalidating also don't express negative emotion very well. They have their own parents, have their own struggle to know how to deal with that. And so to have a kid who's dealing with that feels even more difficult. And there's also this element in the family of high levels of expectations. Kids who struggle with self-injury tend to be very perfectionistic. And really struggle to know how to deal with a B plus or not hitting the ball and getting a triple, and they only got a single. And they struggle with being able to communicate how they feel or even recognizing how they feel. Again, that environment doesn't give them the tools to know how to deal with it. And they also lack self-care. They don't know how to take care of themselves very well. Self-soothing techniques are an important thing that you learn at two. You know, you suck your thumb, you have your teddy bear, you go to your mama. But these teenagers don't know how to do that as a teenager. They don't know how to self-soothe and take care of themselves. And so self-injury becomes a thing that will do that for them. And they also have a history of abuse, something going on in there that's a struggle. But why, right? It just seems... it doesn't make sense. Why would you hurt yourself? Sometimes you can take a shower. You can talk to a friend. You can put on lotion. There's a lot of things that you can do that kind of take care of yourself. You can write for a guy. They can maybe go for a run. They can take a shower. Baths are also very self-soothing. There's a lot of different things that we do. Journaling is a place where you are getting out your feelings in a healthy way. It's good. It's like self-care skills are really important. So, but what are they? Why do they do this? It can be for punishment. Kids who struggle with self-harm carry a lot of shame, and so they think they deserve it. Again, that very perfectionistic kid didn't get the perfect grade. Now they deserve to be punished because they didn't achieve what they thought they were supposed to. It's also to relieve pain, and they feel too much. It's too much. And so self-harm, that dopamine hit that comes in kind of helps them calm down. The bummer is that it's really effective. It's just like, okay, God, you created us to be fearful, or fearfully and wonderfully made, and how do our brains even do this? But it does. So they're trying to punish themselves, relieve some pain, or to feel something. Sometimes kids are so numbed out and detached and disassociated that it's just to feel something. Or it's to express a lot of the ick that's going on inside of them. And signs and symptoms of this, scars, kids tend to use, and people tend to use the arms, and then the upper thighs are places that they use because it's easily accessible. But a big red flag for me is when I see kids wearing hoodies and jeans and it's a billion degrees outside. So when they're covering their body, it's not necessarily. I have a kid who's very thin and he always has a hoodie and pants on because he just isn't comfortable with his body. But for self-harmers, they don't want anyone to see that stuff. They're not comfortable disrobing in front of even that maybe their mom or their same-sex parent. They may say no to going to sleepovers or pool parties because someone might see. They're secretive. They don't want the attention. It's the opposite. They have so much shame and embarrassment. They don't want anyone to know. Okay. So I would look for scars. Scars that are different varying degrees of healing. That's something to pay attention to. Another factor, a sign of this, is just emotional instability, unpredictable, and then expressions of helplessness and hopelessness, feeling really down. Okay, so now we're going to move on to suicide. And I apologize, this, you know, preparing this for me, I was like, Lord, I've spoken up here before, and I get to dive deep into the word, which I really love, and yet I don't know how to do that and give parents tips. It's really hard for me to figure out. So if you guys have feedback that you think might be more helpful, that would be great, because I'm going to be up here all summer. So I love feedback. That would be helpful. Okay, so suicide. Unfortunately, kids are more and more depressed and anxious. Unfortunately, the iGen generation, which is after millennial, it's the new up-and-coming generation. The invention of the iPhone, the smartphone, has had such a huge, huge impact on their mood and their ability to manage. And that's another whole talk that I won't go into. But having access like this for a brain that is so influential, it has a lot of negative effects. So kids are struggling. Unfortunately, suicide is the second leading cause of death for 10 to 24-year-olds. That is huge, preventable, right? So we really need to take this seriously. And some common myths that are out there about suicide, one is that if people are talking about it, they won't really do it. This is the opposite is true. Almost everybody who has attempted or has completed suicide has talked about it. And so any of that kind of talk that comes out, take it seriously. Let's see. Another myth is if a person is determined to kill themselves, nothing will stop them. That's also not true. Even the most serious people waver. And this is, to me, such a spiritual battle. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood. There is, to me, when that person is all alone and depressed, they are so vulnerable to spiritual attack and to believe things that are so not true. Suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem, but they're being convinced of that. And so even the most serious, if they're determined, they really don't want to. So by people, they want out. They want out of their pain, and they think this is the only way. Another common myth is that if talking about suicide may give someone the idea. So let's say you have someone who's really not doing well, and you start to talk to them about suicide, you're not going to give them any pointers or ideas that they haven't already thought of. You don't give depressed person ideas. They're usually isolated, and that's just what their automatic negative thoughts and their influences, their evil influences are convincing them of things that are not true. And actually talking, like say if you talk, so I'll in a bit I'll talk about what to do if someone says that they are thinking about harming themselves, and if you ask them, have you ever had a plan, I should have a plan. They've probably already thought of a plan if they're really serious, but. Yes. Absolutely. Yes, we're going to talk about that. So I think that some people, the myth is that if I actually talk to them about their plan or what they're thinking about, their really dark, evil thoughts, that somehow you will give them ideas that they didn't have before. And that just doesn't happen. Talking to them really gives them permission to openly discuss the things that are really dark and evil in their heart, and provides them an avenue to recognize there's other ways, that they're not alone. I think that's part of the evil, is that Satan convinces us that we're all alone in this, and that is not true. So the last myth is that people who attempt suicide and don't complete suicide are just trying to get attention. Now, some of that is true, in that they are saying, help. But any attempt is serious, and they are desperate. And so anytime you stumble along anything, is to take it seriously. You know, unfortunately, so much of this is in the media. You know, we recently, I'm sure you've heard on the news, there have been a couple of famous people who have tragically taken their life. And that is one of those risk factors, actually, to be exposed to other people's suicides. And when we have the blessing of the internet, it's everywhere. And so people who are attempting or talking about it, we need to take that very seriously. So what are some other risk factors? Well, people with mental health issues are extremely vulnerable to this. That is my brother's story. He has mental health issues, and that if he didn't have those, I don't think he would have attempted to take his life. So if you have kids who have mental health issues, they are more vulnerable to this as a solution to their struggle. Substance use, adults who use substances are more likely to complete suicide. Chronic pain, that's another one, that's one of those that adds to the struggle. Being harassed and bullied, prolonged harassment and bullying has such a huge impact on our teens. Exposure to lethal means, and the reason why that is a risk factor is because if they have access to drugs, if they have access to guns, then that makes it so much easier to fulfill a plan. Exposure to other people's suicide, we talked about that, or a family history. So when I've got kids who are depressed in my office, the first things I ask them is, have you ever tried to commit suicide in the past? Previous attempts increase the likelihood of it happening again. And if you have family members who have attempted suicide, that also makes you more vulnerable. Okay, and then just being exposed to graphic and sensational acts of suicide, like 13 Reasons Why. I can't tell you enough, do not let your kids watch that. And if they're determined, then watch it with them. I mean, I wouldn't want it to happen at all, but then you can at least have a conversation about it. But sensationalizing, taking your life is just not what our kids need. Warning signs, things to pay attention. Unbearable pain. If they're talking about helplessness, hopelessness, they're really struggling, pay attention to that. If they talk about not having any reason to live, they stop talking about future plans. You know, maybe they were preparing to go to college and now they just don't even want to go. Pay attention to that. They might be making suicidal threats through Snapchat, online. That's to be taken seriously. Where else are we? Preoccupation with death. Sometimes kids will listen to music that will just reaffirm whatever they're feeling. And so if they are listening to things and they also exhibit expressions of hopelessness, that's something to pay attention to. Their mood, they might be irritable, more irritable and aggressive. A lot of despair. Apathy is a big one. Loss of interest in things that they normally really enjoy. And this is true for any human being. And then the thing that I want you to know that for me is the most important indicator when it comes to mood change. When you're really, really depressed, you may be numb and not have the energy to take your life. It takes too much work. I know that sounds crazy. But it's when kids or people start to feel a little bit better that they're most vulnerable to this, because now they have energy. And if you notice that all of a sudden they're happy, for me, that is a huge red flag, because now they have discovered, I know what I'm going to do. Now I have hope to be done with this pain, right? They've already thought about what they're going to do and how they're going to do it, and now I have a way out. So if they're not good for a long time, then now all of a sudden they're feeling better, and there isn't any other, like, they're not getting help, they're not seeing a clinician, they haven't gone into inpatient, and now all of a sudden they're better, pay attention. So behavior to look at is they might increase their amount of substance use, they're acting more reckless, they're isolating, they might be drinking or smoking in their room, their sleep and eating is going to be off, they're going to lack hygiene. And another really important indicator to their behavior is the things that they're responsible for, like school or work. If there's a decline in their normal ability to do well in school, then that's something's going on. It doesn't necessarily mean suicide, but it's something to pay attention to. And obviously, if they start to visit people they haven't seen in a long time, they're making phone calls to say goodbye, and giving away things that are really precious to them is an indicator as well. Okay. Oh, it's already noon, seriously. Bummer. This is the part that I really want you guys to hear. What to do? Okay, I'm going to just speed through some of this stuff. I'm bummed. Okay. Really, the thing to do is to be on your knees and pray. Pray and pray for comfort, because this is hard and exhausting. These issues are hard. They don't just go away. And as people who love teens, to be present and draw near to them is going to be hard. And so as couples, as parents, as community members, you need to be there for each other. Because how to be there for each other? So he has his things going on. Mm-hmm. To cope. Yeah, really self-injury and substances. And it's really difficult when they're 24. You know, even a teenager who's 14, you can't really put them on a timeout. I mean, they can run away. They can fight back. And it's really scary. And that's why I think prayer is so important, and to let go of this idea that you can't admit that your kids are struggle. You need help. Got to let go of the potential shame that might be there, because you need wisdom. You need support. You need people who can love you to be able to do this enduring journey with kids who are going to struggle. And the thing that's really hard about teens is trying to figure out what's going on. It's kind of like veterinary medicine. They don't talk. They're not going to tell you stuff, right? It's really hard. They're not going to maybe really help you out on this issue. And so what I would do is assume that if you hear anything from them, it's probably being minimized, unfortunately. Because again, developmentally, they want to stay attached and close and have a positive relationship, and yet they still want to do what they want to do. So they don't really want you to know exactly what's going on. We're supposed to be done in, 10 minutes? Is this really it? Is I only get you guys till 12? Does anyone have to leave and go get kids? Does anyone want to hang out for a little bit? Go late? Is that cool? Okay. Yes. Okay. So if kids are minimizing and they're trying to figure out how to be who they are, then you got to pay attention to their actions, their behavior. Those are things that are going to be harder to hide. Right? And that will give you a little bit more of an indicator of what's going on. And the hard thing about teens is, they're busy. They're out. They're doing things. Or they're in their room not doing anything, and they won't let you in. The door is closed, right? And so you still got to work on that attachment to your kids. I think as a working mom, my thought was, I really need to be there when they're little. But working with teens really shows me that that's when you need to be present. Because they're like two-year-olds, honestly, like, but in more higher risk situations. You know, two-year-olds are putting things in their mouth that they find on the ground, and unfortunately, so do teens, and it's more dangerous. So they need a present love object that's going to be someone that they feel attached to. So being close to your teens is really important. Okay. Oh, okay, here we go. So what I would say is that we're going to this love, listening, and limits part. And I would say with teens, lectures are not going to work if they're not really a customer to what you're selling. Does that make sense? If they're not buying what you're selling, you guys are wasting time. If anything, they're inside already thinking something else. And it's not going to have the impact that you want. So if they're not really customers, then I would ask questions more than give answers. Teenagers need to learn how to problem solve for themselves in order to be independent. And so get them to think about, okay, this has happened. What's your plan? How are you going to handle that? If you are out with someone and they all were pressuring you to do this, what are you going to do? As a parent, you need to see that they know how to deal with whatever that is. And that you'll get that from asking questions as opposed to just telling them what they're doing is not okay. What's really important, I think, in adolescence is to be connected to them in their independence, that they feel confident that you love them and you care about them no matter what mistakes that they make. Think connection before direction. If you're not connected to your kid, you're not going to be able to direct your kid, because you're already pushed out of the circle. So you need to spend time with them. And this is the hard thing. Kids sometimes are, I got two in college and one high school kid. Sometimes they're not very likable, let's be honest. Because their brains are cuckoo and they say things impulsively and you're like, really? I feed you and gave you life. Can we think about this and do this a little differently? Right? So it's hard to want to spend time with kids who are doing dumb things, but they need you to lean in. They need you to be roots for them because they're blown around in the wind. So the more you are attached, the more influence you will have. To me, it's really interesting. Kids want freedom and we want influence as parents. Really, our precious commodity as parents is they care and want to hear what we have to say. We've been around longer. We've experienced some things. We might have some wisdom for them. They don't have to listen to that. So really, when my kids want to know what I think, I was like, yes, right? Kids, they want to be able to go do what they want to do. And all of that is built on trust. And trust is not built if they're not connected. So that's why it's really important. I would suggest if you need to talk to them about something, don't do it spontaneously. They're going to just be reactive and defensive. Make an appointment. Say, we need to talk. When's a good time? Let them mentally kind of get their head around the idea that they're going to have a conversation about them. Because accountability is really important. But they tend to have zero motivation to deal with whatever it is. So give them some time to be ready and mentally prepared. And I think encouragement for kids is really important. If they're not willing to let you in, speak to them as if they are the person the Lord is going to have them become someday. Let me say that again. They may not be there yet, but they need to know that we believe that one day the Lord will redeem whatever brokenness and struggle that they have, and they will be more like Christ. I know I need that as an almost 50-year-old. I don't know what it's like to be in my 50s yet. I want encouragement and support and someone to believe in me. And our kids absolutely need that because they're trying to figure out who they are. So if we speak to them as if they're going to be that person, they'll go, oh, my parents believe in me. So they really need that encouragement. But they also need limits. I didn't talk about this, but the brain grows from the brainstem forward to be fully developed. The prefrontal cortex is the place where all the executive higher functioning happens, like delayed gratification. So they need breaks. They need parents who are willing to say no. And they need clear breaks. They need to know, if I do this, this happens. And in that situation, kids need to know. I've had kids who are allowed to do whatever they want to, and I can tell you that they are sad. My mom doesn't even care when I come home. She doesn't care I'm sleeping on someone else's floor or that I came home high. They want you to care. Now, they won't say that to your face, just so you know. But you take care of what you treasure. And so they need limits, because I know you take care of and you love your kids. So be consistent and be predictable. Be clear. And have whatever limit you set, have it make sense to whatever they're dealing with. Know that an over-controlling parent will always get fired. You want to have influence. Okay. And also know that when you're dealing with a situation, take time, pray. If you discovered something, because that's maybe what you're most likely going to do, really settle yourself. Don't engage in this conversation in anger. Call somebody, have them pray for you if you feel overwhelmed. That way you can really be settled and be prepared for this conversation just as much as they are going to be ready for it. It's always more difficult to change course than set a direction, right? So if you have time and you sit and you pray and you ask the Lord for help, and maybe you've called some people, then you kind of know a little bit about where you want to go. But if you're doing it on the fly and then you find yourself way over here and you're like, shoot, it's harder. Okay, and now I'm going to fast forward through so much stuff. Okay. Another issue about this, just small, this is parenting that I do with a lot of parents, is that redemption is so important to be a part of our discipline. We want kids to learn. We want our discipline to help them learn and not just be punitive. And God the Father is not that way. His discipline is corrective, not punitive. And we want our kids to grow. And we want them to know that they can redeem whatever situation they're in, no matter how bad it is. I mean, God's word is just littered with redemption, right? Look at the gospel. That the kids believe and know the way, the path to redemption. I blew it, but I know that this plan that I've put in place with my parents will help me get out of the situation, repair the situation. But if you're not clear, then how do they know what to do? If you just take a phone away, you've just put pause on the brokenness. It hasn't been healed. And you need to see that you build trust that way if they know the way out, because you get to see it and they get to experience it. Okay. So when it comes to substances, most likely you're going to find something. They're not going to tell you. And I guess that what I would say is, and it's so hard to figure out what to do as parents, but I would want you to kind of try to know where they sit on that use addiction continuum. Is this just I went out with friends and smoked pot, and they've done it a couple of times? What you're going to do in that situation is going to be very different than a habitual abusive use of substances, because they're going to need help at that point. And it may be an outpatient program, it may be a therapist, it may be an inpatient program. But intervention is really important sooner than later. And that's why being present, being connected to your kid will help you have more information than less. Okay. Okay, self-injury. Let me give you some things to think about with that. Remember, self-injury is an attempt to try to cope with a lot of emotion. And they honestly think you're going to freak out because it's weird. It's a little bit more known about, but they're just mainly worried that you're going to make it worse and that you're going to freak out and that you'll think that they're crazy. So it's important to talk to kids about any of these issues. And I would say also I'd recommend that the parent that is the most bonded parent is the one to have the conversation, because I think they're going to be more likely to be honest and more a customer, if that makes sense. And if you have a kid who you think might be self-injuring, showing people their wounds is extremely vulnerable, and they may not want you to see. It is kind of helpful, though, if you can eventually see, because then you can kind of assess how often this is going on and how bad it is to know what kind of help that they need. But if you don't have a good relationship, don't ask to see. They may not be ready. But that can help you know how severe this is. Because I've had some clients who they've done it a handful of times and actually told their parents. And really, I'm not worried about that as a clinician because that was maybe a period of time. And then our work is to help them know how to deal with the underlying issues of extreme emotion. But a therapist can help you figure out where they're at on that continuum. Okay, for suicidal behavior, what I want you to know is that you got to have a conversation. Even if they're making really extreme choices with substances and they're lying and they're coming home late, you want to try to get a read on how depressed they are, if they are depressed. And if they are, if they admit that they're sad, then you need to ask if they've ever thought about taking their own life. And oh, I know this is a hard question, but it's got to be asked. And they might say, no, I would never do that. Okay, well, that's called suicidal ideation. They're just wishing Jesus would come back and have this be done. But they have no real plan. But you still need to draw near to them, comfort them, pay attention to them, get them help. Don't maybe leave them alone as often. You don't want to isolate someone who's admitted that kind of thing. But if they say, yes, I have thought about killing myself, then you want to ask if they have a plan. And you want to ask specifics about a plan. The two things you want to assess are accessibility and lethality, right? Worst case scenario, you have a loaded gun in your hand. That is extremely lethal and easily accessible. So you want to create a safety plan. If they're willing to tell you what their plan is, then you want to remove accessibility to whatever it is and to make sure that they're not alone, because kids are sneaky. They will go into the garage and find the knives that you moved out. Or if you do have guns in your house, you know, I encourage you to have those locked up anyway. But you want to make sure that whatever accessibility they could have is eliminated. And if they're really, I think on the handout I gave you guys, there's some hotline numbers that are on there. And I would say that those are, they say that they have a plan and you want them to be able to talk to a professional because it's 2 a.m, have them call a hotline number. And they'll get some help immediately at that point. But they also might need to go to a mental health unit right away because they are in danger to themselves and you need them to have accessibility to a psychiatrist who has the ability to kind of figure out what to do and what's underlying. And that Santa Cruz County, unfortunately, my county's mental health services are not awesome, which is such a bummer. So I think maybe what's more typical is they might admit them and keep them for a couple of days and then have recommendations. And I had a kid who was attempted and needed physical care and they just released her right away. And I was like, seriously? Are you kidding? Now? Okay. So don't be surprised that if you end up going to take your kid or someone that you know who's really struggling, then know that it may only be immediate relief. And then trying to find some more long-term care. And there's 2 different types of care. It can be residential treatment, where they go for a period of time, or there's something called an IOP, which is an intensive outpatient treatment, where they go almost all day, but they stay and they sleep at home. But they're going to get wraparound services, usually at something like that. But even though you're taking care of your kids' needs, you need to take care of your own. And I don't have this on my my sheet, but the National Association for the Mentally Ill, NAMI, is a national organization. And they have free support groups all over the nation for parents and for kids. And in order for you to get the support that you need through this enduring struggle, that you might have someone in. And they tend to be run by volunteers, but volunteers who have maybe dealt with that specific issue, and they can really kind of understand and empathize. And it is hard, I think, as a parent or as a family member with someone who has struggles, is how do you relate to someone now? How do I don't even know how to talk to you about even the sermon on Sunday, because all I can think about is keeping my kid alive. And it might be really hard to know how to relate to other people. And so it's really important as family members to find other people who understand and can support and give the care that you need while you take care of your kid. Okay, I apologize. I bounced all over my, because of running up here late without my little sheets. Sorry. Definitely not perfect. But I would really love to pray for you guys, and I'll hang out too. Father God, thank you that you are good. Thank you that you're good in the valley of the shadow of death, that you are there, that you have not left us. And so we have hope, knowing that you heal no matter what. Maybe not on this earth, Lord, but you always heal. We thank you so much for knowing that there is good at the end of our journey here. And Father, I pray for these family members, these people who care about kids, and I thank you so much for their courage to come to my seminar when they're retreating and they're relaxing and probably having fun. Lord, just be with them as they leave this mountain and reality hits them, Lord. Please comfort them. Draw near to them. Help the parents. So much stress is on the parents to figure out what to do, and sometimes there's conflict. Lord, please protect the parents and their communication and their love and attachment for each other. And I pray for whatever teens that are represented here that are struggling, Lord. I pray they see you. I pray they see hope and identity in you, that their story is with you. And Lord, go forth. I am going to trust that already good has happened. Help them to see good in this brokenness, Lord. Give them glimmers of hope while they're up here, Lord. And may these families be able to have moments together, bonding moments together. Thank you for the privilege, Lord, that you've given me to be able to speak. And I pray that you take my what I lack and that you multiply it, Lord, and that we're able to save some lives. And it's in your name. Amen.